Good evening, everybody. So welcome to the London School of Economics. I'm Wouter den Haan. I'm a professor here at the Economics Department. And it's my pleasure to welcome Bill Morneau to the LSE. And before introducing our speaker, I would like to make a couple announcements. So please turn off your mobile phone. I ask that every time, and it still happens that some people, you know, completely embarrass themselves. So check, just to be sure. For those of you who want to, you know, use Twitter, the hashtag is LSE Canada, not very original. The event is being recorded, and so if everything goes well, then we will make a podcast available on the LSE events website. And the plan for this evening is that after the introduction of our speakers, there will be time for Q&A. And we should be out of here by 6:15. And so now let me turn to the more important part of my job, and that's to introduce our very distinguished guest. So Bill Morneau is currently Minister of Finance of the Canadian government, which probably you guys already knew. But he hasn't been a politician for very long. So before that, he worked at a human resources services organization that grew massively during his leadership. And he has also done a lot of substantial charity work. And there's a long list that I found on Wikipedia and on the website of the Canadian government. And I picked just one. This is that he founded the School of Somali and Sudanese Youth for an African refugee camp. And the most important thing is that he's actually a former student of LSE. So we're actually very proud to have him back. So please join me in welcoming our speaker for this evening.
Well, thank you very much. And you just heard that he said that if tonight goes well, it will be on the website. So not sure what that means, but I'm certainly aspiring to have it go well tonight. So it's up to all of us. For me, it's a great pleasure to be here. As you just heard, I was a student here now seems like a fair number of years ago. And I have very fond memories of going to the London School of Economics. I have fond memories of living in London House. I don't know if there's anyone here who lives in William Goodenough House or London House. Anyone? At least a few, yes. Which was certainly one of the high points of being here. But also I had great recollections of my tutor. My tutor was a gentleman who unfortunately passed away in the year 2000. But his name was Philip Windsor. So you can imagine, as a Canadian coming abroad to someone and he's your tutor and he's named Philip Windsor, it was interesting to say the least. I don't know what your experience is like, but he had a bottle of scotch in the second drawer of his desk. And the exciting part was that you always were hoping that he might actually share a glass with you. As it turned out for me, he did, but it was after I finished my thesis. So I guess that was the way that I was celebrating the year of work that I had here. So it's truly great to be back here. As you just heard, I've done a number of things in my career. I had the opportunity to build a business, to take what was a family business from a relatively small business with a couple hundred employees to a business with about 4,000 employees, mainly across North America, with some other offices around the world. And more recently, I've had the very exciting opportunity to represent citizens in Toronto Centre, which is where I'm from, and be a member of the Canadian government as the Minister of Finance, working with Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. And I can tell you it's been a very, very exciting and worthwhile endeavor over the last 12 months, and we're looking forward to continuing our efforts over the coming years on behalf of Canadians, and I know there are many Canadians here, so on behalf of you. So I thought I'd start my talk today by just talking a little bit about the trajectory so far in being in office. About a year ago, just after I was sworn in as finance minister, one of the very first things I did was I had the opportunity to get on the prime minister's plane with him to go to Antalya, Turkey, for our first international meeting. It was a G20 meeting in Antalya, and that was our opportunity to tell the world a little bit about what we were all about. We We started that discussion by talking about the values that we held dear and what it was that we brought to the office. So we talked about the need for a government to be inclusive, to think about the importance of dealing with those most vulnerable in our society, and also to think about the middle class and how we can ensure that the growth and the economic activity that we create benefits all of our citizens. That was the message that we brought to that meeting. We talked about retirement security. We talked about the need to deal with students who are facing challenges. We talked about the need to help families as they're raising their children at the most challenging times of their life. But as we were talking about that, as we were talking about our objectives to put people first and to ensure that growth was inclusive, we met with some certainly positive reactions, but not with a uniformly positive reaction at that very first G20 meeting in Antalya. We had some in the rooms there, the International Monetary Fund being a notable example, talking about the message we were taking, the idea of inclusive growth, the idea of making significant investments in infrastructure alongside helping the middle class, and they were entirely on board. But not everyone was on board, and I'd like to talk a little bit about that trajectory through my discussion today. Some of the biggest changes we've seen over the course of the last year, of course, have emphasized the importance of that dialogue. We've seen that over the last number of decades, the benefits of growth in many Western industrialized countries have not gone to the entire society, that they've disproportionately gone to the wealthiest 1%. So many Canadians and many people that we've seen around the world feel let down. And we've seen that anxiety and disenchantment has really been at the heart of some powerful movements that we've seen around the world during the course of our first year in government. So for us, that really was the defining start for us. It was what defined our approach, our shift to not only a people-focused agenda, but one that was more generous and looking towards the future. That was the message we brought to Canadians around this time last year. The message that our global growth can't just be growth for growth's sake, but to make sure that the benefits of that growth do, in fact, go to all cohorts of our societies. But I know that people in this room know that. I obviously have the opportunity to talk to many young people. I have four children of my own. And they talk about their anxiety for the future and the challenges that they see ahead of them. So we in Canada brought to the world the path that that we wanted to talk about. We brought to Canadians the path around inclusive growth. And it's one of the key reasons I'm here in the UK this week to talk about some of the steps that we've taken already in our government and some of the steps that we are looking forward to taking together with Canadians to make a real long-term difference. So for Canada, we know that it's not just a great place to invest and to do business. We know that this push for inclusive growth is something that can make a long-term difference for our society. Our first year of office was one in which we took some really big and important steps to show Canadians the benefits of growth, show them that we see that we need to deal with that anxiety that they're facing. So we started out by doing the things that we knew we had to start with, and that's to show to people the benefits for their families today. So the first thing we did was we decided to lower taxes on middle-class Canadians. So we did that because we know that showing the benefits to the largest cross-section of our population would allow us to start the discussion about what we need to do. So by doing that, we lowered taxes on 9 million Canadians. And at the same time, we raised taxes on the wealthiest 1%, because we realized that that was the part of our society that had done well and could afford to pay a little bit more. We then moved ahead and changed the way we dealt with child benefits in Canada. We know that for families at the most challenging time of their lives when they're raising children, we needed to deal with the increasing anxiety that we were facing. So we means-tested our child benefits in the country, took three separate benefits and moved them into one benefit, and significantly increase the amount of money that lower-income and middle-income Canadians get from those benefits. On average now, for the 9 out of 10 Canadian families that get child benefits, they get about $2,300 more after tax. So you can do the math, as I know many of you are particularly competent at that, to know that that's a pretty important change for many, many Canadian families as they set about to raise their children. So more importantly for us, what that will do is have a very material impact on Canada and on the future trajectory of Canadian children. Because in the year 2017, looking back versus 2014, we'll have 40% fewer Canadian children living in poverty. And that's a pretty enormous number. For you doing the math, that's about 300,000 children that will be raised out of poverty in 2017. So I can tell you that among the many things that I know we'll be proud of in our government, that one important change is something that we know will have a long-lasting impact on outcomes, not only for those young people, but also for our economy over the long term as more people are engaged and able to be part of the Canadian success story. We also started out by making some pretty important changes for young people. We changed the student grant program in Canada for lower-income and middle-income Canadians, increasing the student grants by 50%, knowing that the looming challenge of student debt is one that worries many, if not most, students, and that we needed to make real progress against that. We also told students that they wouldn't have to start paying back student loans until they were earning at least $25,000 a year, at least giving them the ability to get that first job before they actually needed to start paying back that debt. We told Canadians and we told the world that we wanted to embrace diversity as a strength in our country, that our values around diversity were critically important. And we demonstrated that in the most important way by welcoming so many refugees to our shore. We're a country that benefits, obviously, from a geographical advantage in so many ways, but we realized that we needed to play a part in the global refugee challenge. So we opened our doors to more immigrants than ever before over the course of the last year. And we made a statement that was important to the world, but also did it in a way that reflected Canada. It was a public-private enterprise that brought in refugees through our public efforts, but also invited Canadians to be part of that message of openness to global challenge and openness to immigrants and people in real challenge by having them being able to sponsor refugees privately. So as The Economist recently put it, and for any of you who didn't read The Economist a couple of weeks ago, I encourage you to get a copy. I think I might have a few around in case you don't have it. But their quote was that our example shows that tolerance and openness are wellsprings of security and prosperity. And that certainly is the example we want to do to present to the world. We know what strong and confident countries do. We started out with a message on how we can help those people who are struggling, but we're moving forward by investing in the future of our country. And that's because we're optimistic about the opportunities. And we're now out to invest or to work with investors to invite them to be part of this investment in Canada. Yesterday in Toronto, we had a large conference of global institutional investors talking to them about the Canadian opportunity, talking to them about how they could invest in Canadian infrastructure, for example, to not only provide a good return for the pensioners or the people that they're investing their money for, but also to help us to grow our economy. That's a message that we are bringing around the world, and tomorrow I'm talking to a similar group of investors at a UBS investors conference to tell them about why Canada is a good place for them to invest. So our pitch really is this. We proved our resilience and our stability through the global financial crisis and the recent downturn in commodity prices, and we're building on these strengths as we move forward for Canadians. We know that having this effort can make a real difference. Right now, the IMF projects that Canada will have the highest economic growth over the next 5 years, and we want to, of course, make that growth even stronger. We have a highly skilled and diverse and cohesive population. We have the most skilled labor in the G7. We have the highest level of post-secondary education among G7 countries, something that clearly is a huge advantage for companies in Canada, for investors both in Canada and from abroad, as they think about places to successfully grow enterprises and create jobs. Our financial system, as we present to people around the world, is sound. And of course, we know that we can work very well with others. We enjoy a deep economic relationship with the United States, and I know that will almost certainly be a subject of some questions here tonight. But I will tell you that's a relationship that we know will stand the test of time. It's a relationship that's been around, of course, for the entire course of our history, and we have a strong and a deeply intertwined economy with the United States that we know will bode well as we work together with the incoming United States administration. Our signing of the Canada-Europe Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement is not only the most modern and progressive trade deal on the planet, but we know that that shows the world that even in uncertain times, that nations can get together and find a way to advance their collective interests through partnerships, that we can be stronger together through working to find ways to collaborate. So we want to tell the world that that Canada is certainly a place where we can see that we can play a leadership role. Our success, we know, is very much related to our effectiveness in collaborating with people around the world. We know that to get ahead, we need to attract investment and to forge global partnerships, because as a small trading country, that's just the way that it works for our country. So that's why we will be out to promote our economic vision around the world. We will, as we do that, stay true to our values, because we know that that is what so many people look to in Canada. But as we do that, we'll chart an economic growth path that will enable our citizens to be successful over the long term. So our goal will remain open to listening to Canadians and listening to people around the world. We'll be listening to people like the people here in this room. We'll be keeping our doors open to international partners who will see the advantages of working together with us for long-term growth. And, you know, I will say that we are meeting with extremely favorable reaction as we talk about the Canadian advantage around the world. So I want to come back to that meeting in Antalya, Turkey, a year ago, when there were some people who were saying that our message, the message of inclusive growth, the growth part they could see made sense. The investing in the long term made sense. But not everyone was on board for the inclusive nature of that growth. Not everyone was in agreement that you needed to focus on how you dealt with the most vulnerable, how you dealt with middle class, in our case, middle class Canadians. But I'll tell you, there's been a sea change in our world over the course of the last year. So this past summer at the G20 summits in China, and most recently at the IMF World Bank meetings in Washington, I can tell you that everyone is on board for the Canadian example. When we stand up and talk about what we're trying to achieve, when we stand up and talk about inclusive growth, when we stand up and talk about how we need to ensure that the benefits of growth go to all cohorts of our society, that we help the most vulnerable, that we provide opportunity for the middle class, that we give a vision of the future, that's a story that is meeting with a resounding success and resounding support from around the world. So I'm delighted to be here with you today. I'm happy to take questions on really anything you might want to have to ask. And I hope there'll be more questions than just about the U.S. election, but happy to take that question as well. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. So I'm going to use my position as chair first to get the Q&A started with a couple questions. And I'm going to sort of, you know, reveal my my background as a macroeconomist a bit. So you mentioned that the financial system is sound in Canada. And it's definitely true that the financial system weathered the financial crisis quite well in Canada. And So the interesting thing about the Canadian financial system is quite different than in lots of other countries. You have, you know, just a couple really big banks. And so some people would say that's very bad because then there is, you know, not enough competition and not enough innovation. But then others would say, yeah, but then at least these guys are profitable, and then if there's a big crisis, is that they have a bigger buffer. So do you think is that other countries should try to copy the financial system of the Canadians?
Are there a lot of Canadians in the room? So you probably know that in general, as Canadians, we tend to be fairly humble. So let me start by saying my willingness to prescribe what other countries should do is not very high. I think instead what we should be doing is talking about the Canadian example. So as we look at the Canadian banking system, we have more than a couple of banks. We have five large banks and another a sixth bank that's also pretty large. So six Canadian domiciled banks that are fairly significant. And yes, that's a relatively small number compared to many other countries. It is always a balance between the advantages and disadvantages of having what is a fairly small and significant group of banks. The advantage for us is we have a very resilient banking system. We have an approach to banking in Canada that is relatively conservative. We have a very positive situation in terms of loan losses in our country right now. We continue to be seen as one of the soundest banking systems, if not the soundest banking system in the world. So it's always a case of considering the alternative, and when your system demonstrably works so well, I think that provides good impetus for trying to maintain those strengths. We will always try to work to ensure that within the confines of that system that we focus on how consumers are well served. That's important, and we are working on that because that is always something that we'll need to pay close attention to. But I'm pleased as I go around the world that I can say to investors that we have a sound and a resilient banking system.
Great, thank you. So I also want to follow up on what you said about anxiety and an inclusive society. So there is one thing that politicians are becoming worried about, and that's this long period of low interest rates, and is that it's hurting a particular group of people, you know, namely people who want to, you know, save. So rates of returns are low, and if so, you know, like say for retirement you depend on your savings, then that's tough, especially if it lasts so long. And it's even possible is that this long period of low interest rates is no longer expansionary like we hope it is, but it's actually going to be contractionary. So here in the UK, some politicians have criticized the Bank of England for this, you know, this long period of low interest rates. Do you share that concern that, you know, low interest rates could actually be damaging for the economy, or at least for, you know, a substantial group of people?
Let me start by saying that we in Canada have a healthy separation between the Bank of Canada and the Ministry of Finance. So that is something that's worked very well for us, that separation. The independence of the governor has been a positive thing. Our approach at our inflation targeting regime has worked well for us over a long period of stable inflation, giving people a sense of expectations of what the future will look like that allows them to make investment decisions. Of course, the low interest rate environment presents certain challenges for savers. We recognize that. Our approach to working with that, given that that we are firmly of the view that we should keep that separation between the Bank of Canada and the government directly, is thinking about the ramifications. So we've enhanced our Canada Pension Plan in collaboration with provinces, knowing that saving for retirement is going to be more challenging, along with greater longevity for people, which is positive but presents challenges. We've looked at ensuring that our housing market does not have particular challenges as a result of people's proclivity to take on larger debt because of the low inflation environment by putting in some tests, some stress tests in our housing market. So we're trying to deal with some of the impacts of that. And, you know, we will see, we hope that that as our economic growth increases, that the likely interest rate will go up as we have more inflation. I mean, that's what we would expect to happen. Of course, over the last week, we've seen some changes that are, I can't opine on whether they're temporary or long-term, but certainly we have seen that there's at least a possibility of inflation and rate changes down the road.
So I hope I'm not going to start a trend, but I could not resist also asking something about, you know, the consequences of the U.S. election. So you mentioned that, you know, the relationship between Canada and the U.S. is very good, and I'm sure it is, but I'm not sure... That wasn't supposed to be funny, but... But I'm not sure whether, you know, your Mexican counterpart would be, you know, able to say the same. And so I suppose is that the U.S. would actually impose tariffs on Mexico. They would repeal NAFTA, as that they would be, you know, nice to Canada, but they would impose tariffs on Mexico. Now, you would think that because of, you know, supply chain integrations, that actually could be quite bad for Canada, too. Do you worry about that?
So is there anyone here who might be interested one day in potentially being in political office? So, I mean, I've learned something over the course of the last year, and that's when a question starts with if. It's probably good to consider carefully your answer before you reply. You know, clearly, we have an enormous stake in the success of the relationship between Canada and the United States. We also have a stake in the success of the relationship between Canada, the United States, and Mexico. Our supply chains are intertwined. We've developed a very successful economic union over the course of the last, 20-some-odd years. That's something that we see value in. We will work with the United States, and this would go with any U.S. administration, in order to show the benefits of that relationship. We expect that Mexico will be part of that discussion, and while there may be discussions that are bilateral as well as trilateral, we think that that will be a discussion that we'll have together. I am of the view that the advantages that we have in trading, which are demonstrable. We have, in the case of Canada, the U.S., 9 million U.S. jobs are reliant on Canadian trade. 35 of the U.S. states have as their number one trading partner Canada. Another 13 have Canada as their number one, two, or three trading partner. So that's 48 out of 50, and we're working on the last two. There is a strong and deep relationship, and that goes for the Mexican-U.S. relationship as well. So I think that working together is the right thing to do, and it will get us to a conclusion that I think will be mutually advantageous.
Thanks. So now it's your turn. So the way it's going to work is that we're going to collect a couple of questions, and then so please wait until you get the microphone so then everybody will be able to hear you. So there will be stewards ready with a microphone. So the lady there, and then the one here in front, and then after that.
Professor Dunhan mentioned about innovation. And I know that the current inclusive growth plan is focusing on the social side, but what are you planning to do to kind of make sure that business also thrives to be able to provide the jobs that people need? Just a general plan, obviously not asking for details, but a kind of general idea of what you've got going, cooking in the background there.
Okay.
Thank you, Minister, for your talk. I'm from Newfoundland and Labrador, which has obviously been going through some tough economic times, along with other oil-producing provinces in Canada. So I was hoping you could talk about some of the ways that the federal government is working to improve the financial situation in Newfoundland and Labrador, but also in other provinces more generally.
Okay.
And here in the front.
So a question about inflation. As a Canadian, I'm afraid I shouldn't admit that I don't know who gets to define what inflation is. I assume it's the government, not the bank, but the bank has a target it has to meet. But after the tech bubble, Professor Charles Goodhart, who was not emeritus yet at the time, suggested that central banks needed to broaden their view of inflation, perhaps even to look at the stock market. Now, since 2009, there's been a spectacular growth in the U.S., not so much in Canada or the U.K., in the stock market prices. In fact, everyone of working age has to buy a pension. They can do without a flat-screen TV, which is undoubtedly in the inflation basket, but they can't avoid investing in the stock market every year. Year after year, their pension plan has had to make those purchases at ever higher prices. So, of course, the entire 900% or whatever it isn't inflation, but the amount that a person has to put away against their retirement that goes into the stock market, which is almost all of it now, is inflation. Do you have any plans for measuring that in future?
Okay. Every once in a while I get a question that I haven't had before, that's for sure. So maybe I can start with the question around innovation, and it is core to what we're trying to achieve. So we recognize that we're not going to be successful over the long term if we don't create job opportunities and create a more productive environment. Our plan around investments, which we rolled out in our first budget and a little more in our most recent update, was really about our long-term investments in infrastructure, which we do see as part of the need to be more productive. In the case of infrastructure, strong infrastructure, of course, enables for more productive enterprises, better trade corridors, helps businesses to work. But around the innovation agenda, we've heard as we've gone out a few things from investors and prospective investors that we're working on. As you may know, I set an advisory council on economic growth that I've been working with on a number of issues, innovation being one of them. So we've started down this path. The first thing we did in our economic update just a couple of weeks ago is we talked about the importance of talent. So what we heard from businesses that are investing in Canada, businesses that are thinking about investing in Canada, that they really need access to some, in certain periods, some key skills. And those skills can actually enhance their ability to invest and create jobs. So we created a new approach for allowing them to attract talent to Canada. We gave guarantees about how quickly they could move people to the country. We've enabled them to keep people with needed skills on short duration that'll actually help their business. That talent is something we heard about over and over again. We've also heard that the need for capital for innovative organizations is important. So our venture capital industry in Canada has been advanced over the course of the last number of years. The previous government introduced a venture capital approach that's been successful. There's still things to be done, but it's gone relatively well. We've heard from firms that they really need growth capital past the venture capital level. So that's something that we're looking closely at, how we can be part of delivering on growth capital for firms when they get into past the startup phase, maybe past the 0 to 5 million or 10 million in revenue, and from that stage to the up to the $100 million in revenue. So helping at that phase. We've also focused on how we can actually start the flywheel of growth going. So our first step in our first budget was investing in research and innovation centers at universities. We're looking at how we can expand on that to develop clusters and places where organizations can work together with universities and research institutes to actually enhance our collective growth. So the classic example would be Silicon Valley. In Canada, we have the Waterloo-Toronto zone, where we're looking at the significant advantage in digital technology that's gone there. We're looking to find some ways to enhance and improve that over time. So that will be something we'll be talking about over the course of the coming months. With respect to Newfoundland and Labrador and the places in our country that are going through some enormous challenges because of changes in resource prices, We obviously see the very real impacts on Canadians going through job loss. You know, we've had a spike in job losses in Alberta and in Newfoundland. We started off by emphasizing how we could help with that by softening our employment insurance laws to create some or regulations so that people could have longer employment insurance to have more transition. We put additional training dollars into the EI system. But we know that those are measures that will be helpful but not necessarily change the dynamic long term. So we're looking again at how we can be encouraging the kinds of skills that we have in some of those places to continue to be effective for the resource sector, but perhaps broaden out. So if you think about the kind of engineering skills that you would have in and around Calgary because of the resource sector, those are also the sort of resources that might be very effective in the clean energy sector. So thinking about how we can invest to create that sort of environment that helps to change and create additional dynamism in those sectors. And then, of course, we've been standing behind the provinces with giving assistance where required. So in both Alberta and Newfoundland, the two examples that are most stark, they got some additional stabilization funds from the federal government, which we delivered earlier than required. We're working with Newfoundland right now on the Muskrat Falls hydroelectric project to ensure that that project can deliver clean energy over the long term for Canada and make sure that they have the capacity to continue making that investment. So we're standing alongside at challenging times, knowing that it will be helpful that we're doing well in other parts of the country, and that will be positive as well. So finally, around the basket of goods in the bank's targeted inflation, it is a basket that's really run by the bank and not by the Ministry of Finance. I guess I understand what you're saying around stocks. Of course, it becomes somewhat of a circular argument if you start adding in things that create inflation so that you push more inflation. And so we'd want to be careful about thinking about adding non-goods into the basket of CPI. I understand your observation around most, but not all people having equities in their portfolio. But again, it's a Bank of Canada review, and we feel that the inflation targeting regime in Canada has worked quite well. So we are always of the view that to the extent something's worked and it's created a stability and an environment where people can make investments with a good understanding of the long-term outlook for those investments, that we should be careful as we look at making changes to ensure that they enhance our situation. We came to the renewal of our five-year mandate with the Bank of Canada around the 2% midpoint inflation targeting because we had a sense that it had been working well. It had created a sense of expectations. The way Governor Poulos says it, if you walk down the streets of Toronto or Vancouver or Saskatoon and you asked people what they think inflation is, even though right now it might be around 1.1 or 1.2, they'd say 2% because that's kind of what's embedded in their head. And that expectations, it's a positive thing because it allows people to make investments with a sense of the future. So we'll be careful before we consider any changes, and that's how we got to our conclusion.
Thanks. So to make sure the Q&A is also inclusive, let's get some people at the back. Over there on the side first, and then the girl with the glasses in the back. And just go ahead, just get started.
Hello, Minister. Thank you so much for your talk. I'd just like to ask, you mentioned that during the G20 summit there were some parties which had arguments against inclusivity, and I was wondering perhaps what those arguments were, and perhaps your government's take on why, basically how you rebutted those arguments and made your point.
Hi, Katie. Thank you for your talk. So if we think of inclusive growth as something that spreads to each citizen of the country. How would you encourage small and medium enterprises to be able to provide their staff with an inclusive growth? If we think of economy that everyone benefits more and that it improves the well-being of every citizen in the country, because you've just mentioned lowering the taxes and then raising the taxes and something and a little bit about education and helping people raise children, but there is so much more to that. So if you could elaborate a little bit more on that.
And there was a question on the side, a little bit in front. There you go.
Hi, my name is Zach. I have a question about the role of government in employment growth and job quality. So I'm planning on moving back to Canada when I finish my degree here. And last week, Minister, or maybe a couple of weeks ago, you spoke quite candidly about the quality of jobs that young people had in Canada, saying that young people should be getting used to sort of more precarious work, more contract work, shifting careers more and more often. That seems like a pretty significant departure from the historical position of ministers of finance in Canada, which has been to take responsibility, blame, and accolades when it came to the quality of jobs. And I'm wondering if you see that as a shift in the role of government in job creation or not.
Okay. Well, maybe starting in the order of the questions, at the G20, what I was really describing was when we came into office in talking about inclusive growth, the dialogue that had been going on around the G20 table, of course, had been focused on the need for growth. So as we look back over the last decade, a lot of that growth had been focused on monetary policy. And so that, had largely run out of the steam by the time we came into office. And so we brought in a point of view that using fiscal policy with long-term investments could be, the right way to go, should be the right way to go to enhance our growth. But an observation that the increasing anxiety of the middle class, the challenge around technology change and the implications for citizens present a really difficult environment from which people can make long-term decisions if they're feeling like the benefits aren't there for them today. When I say that not everyone was on board, there were a number of discussions where people said, well, is there really anything that we can do against that challenge? You know, what is it that we can do? And our response is that we could not only make important strides to deal with groups that were not seeing the benefits for themselves and their families, and we could do it in a way that captured large cross-sections of the population. So by means testing, you're able to get the lowest income up to a relatively successful family, that we could actually show some benefits. So I think the arguments were, can you do it? I think we showed that not only is it important, but there are things that you can do. And so the change in tone, what's happened is clearly as a result of people seeing the ramifications of people that are not engaged in the growth opportunities. So to me, the rebuttal was very much, here's what we're going to do. We're going to make positive efforts to show benefits to people. And the outcome in our country is, I think, a sense that there is an opportunity for us to continue to make improvements. And it really does bring me to the question from you there on how can we do more. So I think a way is for us, whenever we're thinking about what we're going to do in terms of growing our economy, to think about the impacts that it has on all cohorts of our society. So we're looking at what's the impact on the median income in each quintile of our society as we think about our changes that we might make. As we think about our innovation efforts, we're thinking about, where is this going to hit? We're looking at different subsets of Canadians and trying to deal with their particular issues. We're trying to deal with challenges at students. We've dealt with impoverished elderly by raising our guaranteed income supplement. We've changed the impact on 9 out of 10 families with children. So we're trying to hit at different cross sections of our society that might have been challenged, and then we're thinking about what are the things that can most impact our collective growth going forward. Labor force participation is obviously a critically important thing that has huge inclusive advantages, but it also has economic advantages. So we're very focused on labor force participation of women, labor force participation of new immigrants, labor force participation of Indigenous Canadians, thinking about how we can increase the education and the training and the retraining in those sectors of our population to enhance growth, but also more inclusive growth. And finally, I think it's Zach. Let me go back to what I was saying in that quote that you were mentioning was that we need to face up to challenges in our societies and deal with how we can improve against those. So what we're seeing is, in fact, a bit of a complicated picture in terms of employment. We're actually seeing average tenure of employees in Canada going up, and that's to be expected because of the aging of the population. So over the last decade or so, it's gone from 7 years to 9 years, and that we would expect. When you age adjust it, it stayed pretty consistent. So in fact, average tenure of employees hasn't changed much. But underneath that, there's been a huge change in temporary and contract workers. And it's not something that's unexpected if you think about the volatility of the markets, when you think about the speed of technology change, when you think about globalization. So firms are reacting in ways that are predictable, more contract workers, more temporary workers. So as we deal with that, first of all, you need to say out loud what the issue is. This is a real issue. It's a real issue. It's going to be a challenge for many people in this room. We start by acknowledging it. And then we think about, so what are we going to do about it? So what I was trying to say is, let's acknowledge it first, and let's think about how we deal with it. I talked earlier about the enhancement of the Canada Pension Plan. Well, for people going into a challenging environment where they're going to be in some cases, in contract jobs, of course they're worried about their long-term security. So they're worried about breaks in employment. So let's start by creating some sort of sense that long-term security is better. So we've started with that. Then we're going to need to think about what are the ways that we actually deal with this new environment. We know that education is critically important. We also know that getting people the information on what skills and talents they need is going to be important. So we're thinking about how we deliver to you in this room the information on what you should be studying now and what you should be studying tomorrow, what you should be learning so that you're better prepared for the future. We're going to be thinking about that. We know that skills training and retraining as people move from one job to the next job, often that's a positive, by the way, because there'll be opportunities that they will seek. We'll need to find ways that we can actually be part of that ecosystem to improve the situation. And then, of course, our goal, it's a continuous goal of governments, is to create good long-term jobs. So I'm here in the UK. We were with investors yesterday talking about the importance of infrastructure investment in our country. That'll create good long-term jobs. In my fall economic statement a couple weeks ago, we talked about something called the Invest in Canada Hub. Our observation is with the changing nature of business, with the very attractiveness of Canada, we can get more organizations to invest in Canada if we go about it and do it assertively. So we're going to talk about how we can encourage people to come to Canada. That idea of allowing people to attract key talent is part of that. So we are about acknowledging the challenge, and we are thinking about what we can do to improve it, because we do want everyone in this room to have the opportunity for a great long-term job, or if what you choose is a series of really great jobs that build your skills over time, that's another great way to build a career. We recognize there's more than one path to success, and we want to be engaged in that with you, and the only way to do that is by thinking about the challenges and dealing with it systematically.
Thanks. Okay, so I think there's one here at the front. Here, at the second row. And then after that, the person right there on the side, and then the girl on the side. Perfect. Yeah, perfect.
So we've been talking about Canada as though it's one cohesive economy, but in fact it's quite fragmented. Since 1995, the Agreement on Internal Trade has attempted to remedy that, but around the same time, Minister McCallum published papers talking about how still the impact of a subnational barrier can be almost as great as a national barrier. Since 1995, there hasn't been a great deal of movement in terms of liberalizing trade inside Canada, and recent moves have been led by the provinces as opposed to the federal government. What's the government's agenda for trying to liberalize internal trade and advance it alongside international trade?
You ready? Got the mic? Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Bianca. I was going to ask you a question regarding oil subsidies for Canadian oil companies. I understand that the Liberals promised to eliminate these oil subsidies eventually. I'm not going to ask for a timeline, but I am going to ask, do you think it would be best to do so and fulfill that promise when the industry is at a low or when it's at a higher point where they're making profits?
Thank you for your talk. My question is, how does a government continue investing in inclusive growth whilst maintaining a healthy fiscal position and minimize the deficit?
Well, thanks. I think I'll be relatively quick on a couple of these questions because we'd like to get more answers and more questions. So with respect to the trade barriers within Canada, I agree with you. This has been a long-term challenge. It's a real challenge that we need to deal with. I mean, it's from my perspective, something that we just should get on with. I mean, the idea that we have barriers to to trucks going across the country because of different rules in different provinces certainly seems nonsensical on the face of it. We are clearly interested in working with the provinces to get this continue to make progress in this regard. I will tell you that we are turning our efforts to this. We recognize that in order to be successful in Canada, there's not really any silver bullet. We need to do an awful lot of things well. One of them would be clearly working on internal trade barriers. I'm sorry, I don't have a more specific answer, but it's something that my colleague Navdeep Bains is working on, and I'm of the view that we will make progress, and certainly challenging economic situations in parts of the country actually help us to make progress. So that lack of a one uniform economy presents the opportunity to do more. But it's something we need to remain on top of. With respect to fossil fuel subsidies, obviously as part of our commitments, our global commitments, we are looking at how we can ensure that we gradually change that environment. It's something that we have to look at in terms of efforts we can make. Our first and most important initiative, I think, as you probably know, is dealing with carbon pricing in Canada. That we see as the single effort that can have the biggest impact. So our focus right now is getting to a pan-Canadian approach on carbon pricing. We're making progress on that, and I'm of the view that we will be able to make progress on that in the pretty near term. We'll continue to look at other issues that some of which have to do with the tax code. I'm in the course of my review of tax expenditures, clearly looking at all tax expenditures, one of which would be expenditures that advantage different segments of our industry. Finally, the question around balancing our fiscal position and our investments. I think one thing that all of us who are Canadians can be proud of is that we in Canada have a particularly good, the way I like to communicate, a very good balance sheet and also a good income statement. So we, in terms of a balance sheet, we have the lowest net debt to GDP of G7 countries. That is, right now it's at 26%. It's a third of the United States, just to put it in context. It's the lowest in the G7 on that measure, but it's also the lowest in the G7, even if you add in the provincial debt and look at our net pension assets. So we're still in the low 40s. So we're in a very good position where we were versus where we were a couple of decades ago. It provides for us the opportunity to make long-term investments. Obviously, interest rates are at a place that are advantageous for making those long-term investments now. Our challenge will be always to do that while trying to remain fiscally prudent. So we've chosen to have an anchor of net debt to GDP to maintain that and try and lower it over the course of our mandate, because we see that as important. We've also talked about how we can crowd in private sector investment to infrastructure so that not only do we use public sector investment, but we use private sector investment to have a bigger and more long-term impact. That'll enable us to do more with less. But certainly for us, making investments today over the long term is what we can see as a significant benefit to our economy. And doing that in a fiscally responsible way is critically important for all of our future.
So I was told that people would start yelling at me if we don't end quarter past, because there's an event after this. So I'm afraid that we got to stop right here. But to conclude, I would like to thank all of you for coming. And please join me in thanking our speaker.